thank you for your generous welcome. And it's a real privilege to be invited to an event with such exciting interdisciplinary interventions. And I think today I'm going to perform the role of the somewhat boring social scientist. And I'm going to invite you on a journey through the thrilling worlds of regulation and bureaucracy. So the failures of chemical regulation are central to the crises of planetary health we currently face, we, of course, being uneven and situated, from long-range transboundary air pollution to climate change. So you have captured me in the middle of assembling a new project, and my aim in this talk is to articulate a set of questions for building transdisciplinary research on regulation, to start to decenter scientists and civil servants in regulatory discourses. So to do this, I'm going to bring together the various ways in which I've been encountering chemical regulation and bring these into conversation empirically and conceptually. So really the fragments of practice and thought to think about really just how to move forward epistemologically and ethically. And I'm really excited to hear your thoughts and how you might be asking similar questions in your work. So we're in a moment of chemical regulatory turbulence at a global scale. Responses to COVID-19 led to widespread environmental deregulations in order to meet unprecedented global demand for disinfectants and biocides. And so this is a really different pollution story to the kind of story we've been hearing from Neri on COVID-19. Another kind of element of our regulatory turbulence is the European Commission just released a roadmap in 2022 to transform how chemicals are regulated in the EU. The United States is grappling with the aftermath of the Trump administration's deregulatory actions within the Environment Protection Agency, and the UK is struggling with a lot of things, but is struggling to regulate chemicals after losing access to EU databases during Brexit. Sorry. we're going to linger with the UK a bit. I like trashing on our government in mainland Europe proper. Anyway, so in January, The Guardian reported that whistleblowers from the UK Environment Agency had been instructed to no longer respond to low-impact pollution events. So chronically underfunded, England's environmental regulator has made significant cuts to the investigation of pollution reports, while at the same time, pollution permit fees and charges are a key source of income for the agency, constituting 32% of their budget in the last financial year. Whistleblowers at the Environment Agency explained to The Guardian that most permit applications are being approved, and I'm going to quote one of them here. We're told, largely through the permitting process, to give business the benefit of the doubt rather than the environment. Unless you can find a 100% solid reason not to grant something, you will grant it. The precautionary principle, which is what a lot of these decisions should be based on, is not prevalent. We don't really get to use it. So while reports of institutional failure unfold in the Environment Agency, further up the chemical supply chain, the UK government is establishing a new system for regulating chemicals. This regulatory reconfiguration is taking place across a number of key government agencies as a result of our contested and protracted and ongoing departure from the EU. So the new chemical regulatory system will be an adaptation of the EU's registration, evaluation, authorization, and restriction of chemicals. So what I'll call from now on is REACH. So REACH, where UK REACH, will be administered by the UK's Health and Safety Executive. So how is UK REACH going? Well, the UK House of Commons requested an assessment of how regulators are managing the Brexit transition. This report was published by the National Audit Office in May, and it found that the civil service is experiencing a range of what they call challenges in performing new regulatory functions that were carried out by EU institutions prior to Brexit. The report outlines that the Health and Safety Executive has gaps in the necessary skills and expertise among staff to regulate chemicals, and operational challenges are being compounded by the significant loss of data and information sharing agreements with EU regulators. It explains in the report, and I quote, "Capacity constraints could, they are, delay regulatory decisions. For example, the Health and Safety Executive has extended approvals for biocidal active substances due to expire in 21-22 to at least 23 while it develops its biocide active substance assessment program." So in other words, approvals are, we're going to have kind of continual approvals while the agency kind of gets its shit together. So it's important to stress that chemical regulation has implications for all forms of health and that the effects of chemicals always transgress borders. So what feels like a UK issue quickly becomes a planetary health issue. Public health and environmental health civil society organisations are assembling in response to the Brexit transition and are expressing concern over the influence of industry in this process, particularly as the UK is departing from what's often imagined as the gold standard of precautionary regimes. So environmentalist discourses, I would say dominant white environmentalist discourses, routinely call for stronger regulations in this kind of context. However, if we think about the kind of work from Max Liberon and Michelle Murphy that was cited earlier, the fundamental logics and processes of dominant regulatory systems create social, racial, environmental, and epistemic injustices. As we mentioned earlier, chemical regulations are based on risk managerial logics, which falsely assume that safe levels of chemical exposure are possible. Moreover, chemical regulations center regulatory science and scientific expertise in ways that exclude the publics most heavily affected by chemical exposure, and the knowledges that are required to put regulations into practice downstream in supply chains. So my research on chemical waste over the past several years has ultimately demonstrated how even when working effectively, regulations can compound the injustices they aim to address. So this moment, I'm going to be hopeful momentarily, this moment of regulatory turbulence invites a critical reconsideration of regulation as a problem, as an object of analysis, and as a site for intervention. So, what do the social sciences and humanities have to say about regulation? And might they offer a way forward? In some ways, yes, but staying for a moment with the literature before we move on, there are three fundamental limits in our research thus far. First, regulation is quite narrowly conceived as the work of civil servants and regulatory scientists. So this regulatory imaginary excludes the knowledge and expertise of those working most closely with chemicals and experiencing the greatest burdens of exposure. So this is marginalised and poorly compensated labour. The work of cleaners, hairdressers, farmers, construction workers and waste disposal technicians. These chemically intensive jobs are classed, racialised and gendered. Another regulation problem is that it's also fragmented across problem domains and disconnected from questions of management and use downstream. And therefore, it reproduces tensions between occupational health and environmental health. So by extension, labour justice and environmental justice. So they've been historically at odds. So most importantly for me, at least in this talk, is regulatory research rarely moves beyond critique and remains within the boundaries of existing regulatory imaginations. Now, accounts of failure are important, and a lot of this is about failure, so I'm going to contradict myself, but accounts of failure are important, but they can compound violence and reduce places and bodies to their damage. Furthermore, damage-centered analyses maintain the dominance of regulatory science and risk management. And so these arguments have emerged from anti-colonial feminist scholars in STS working with chemicals. So the question for myself, how might social scientists intervene to think beyond dominant regulatory imaginations to enable more just chemical regulations? Dominant systems are currently foreclosing possibilities for environmental and epistemic justice by requiring that regulatory discussions always take place on scientific terms. So before we start rethinking regulation, what does it actually look like in practice downstream? And so I'm going to spend most of the rest of the talk kind of exploring this and seeing where it takes us. In 1986, 220 tons of organochloride pesticides were dumped in the village of Vaikugi in eastern Tanzania on a state-owned farm. Its origin was Greece. This photograph was taken 3 years after its arrival by a civil servant. He worked for the Environmental Regulatory Agency. I first encountered the story of this stockpile when writing an undergraduate essay. I went on to trace the life of these chemicals for my PhD. This multi-sided ethnography examined the transboundary disposal processes which render these kinds of banned pesticides manageable. This is a close-up inside the shed. Sacks filled with broken bottles, chemicals spilling out into the soils, groundwater, and out through the hydrological cycle. This photo was taken by Heinrich Klinn, an environmental chemist researching the site in 2002. I interviewed him, and he explained how pesticide containers are pivotal forms of evidence for understanding what the contamination might be, how chemists should design their research, and what risk management procedures should be in place for remediation. This is our first encounter with the chemical bureaucracy. Chemicals here are just as much bottles, labels, and instructions as they are molecular formations. They're what Andrew Barry terms informed materials. Most of these labels were in Greek, suggesting that they were manufactured in Greece, or at least this was their last point of departure. Photographs of death populate Heinrich's research archive. We discussed the extent of pollution in the village and the difficulty of knowing the full range of chemicals at the site. Chemicals change over time, meaning that some of the chemicals that were present during his field trip were not manufactured, but rather emerged through exposure to heat. his research found that this is one of the most heavily contaminated pesticide sites in the world, which really makes me think of the question of the ethics of kind of rendering pollution visible. The stockpile is one of countless others located in Tanzania and across the continent. Like other cases of toxic waste dumping in the 20th century, there were no legal mechanisms for regulating the movement of hazardous materials. So, in other words, this was unjust but not illegal. It's an exploitation of loose regulatory structures underpinned by a racialized disregard for lives, practices which continue to this day. Public health research had been conducted at the village, which is no less than 500 metres downhill. And I spoke with the researchers who undertook this epidemiological work, and they told me it's a cancer hotspot, but the results were never published. And the data, again, wasn't shared with communities in a kind of classic form of research extractivism. I took Heinrich's photos of Greek pesticides with me to Athens, and I was determined to figure out how and why these pesticides made their way to this particular village. I realise now, kind of many years later, the arrogance of this method, and I would have done this differently now. So my first interview with civil servants was in the Greek Ministry of Agriculture, and like all other field encounters with Greece, in Greece, our conversations emerged with questions about my heritage. And so although Greek is my first language, it bears a kind of thick Australian accent on top of it. As I began to ask about pesticide exports, this civil servant defensively explained that their archives were located in a different building. He claimed that he didn't know where the records might be kept or even if they existed. And it became clear that he'd only pursue this issue if it became a political problem. After a series of awkward interviews with regulators and manufacturers that refused to be recorded, I took the bus to Thessaloniki. Michalis, a lawyer and former member of European Parliament, had agreed to meet me for a coffee downtown to talk about toxic waste in Syndos, the city's major industrial hub. During my stay, he accompanied me to the environment regulatory offices, and he was determined to find the elusive files on pesticide exports to Africa. And also, almost after kind of 2 hours of crisscrossing floors and being redirected from one office to the next, the civil servants explained that any paper trail for this export of pesticides would have likely been destroyed. And although there was no paperwork, there was still an institutional memory, and it took the form of the rumour. Officers were not surprised by the story of this stockpile. They speculated that the source was likely to be connected to Diana, a Greek chemical distributor based in Thessaloniki that filed for bankruptcy in the early 1980s. Diana emerged in my conversations across the public and private sector, and the dominant narrative was that the company had a vast stockpile of expired pesticides. The Greek government seized Diana's assets after filing for bankruptcy, but these pesticides were effectively hazardous waste. Stored for years in a shed in Syndos, the stockpile became an environmental emergency with a chemical spilling, mixing, transforming, and becoming at risk of explosion. It was suggested that those who would have direct knowledge of the stockpile were either no longer at work or no longer alive. Michalis speculated that the Greek government would have probably disposed of these pesticides through the guise of an aid donation to Tanzania. The contaminated Syndos industrial zone in Thessaloniki is now a camp for refugees. In 2012, the stockpile was removed from the farm by Veolia Field Services. After seeping into the topsoil and groundwater, it was repackaged and shipped to Poland to be incinerated. Veolia is contracted by intergovernmental agencies to undertake a variety of infrastructural programs. And this one was funded by the World Bank, cleaning up the toxic legacies of 20th century chemistry's miracles. So my next destination was an industrial park in Wales, the headquarters of Veolia Field Services. And James, The manager of the field services team and I went through their removal project archives together. And this is one of the photos used to evidence that the process of removal was done in compliance with standard operating procedures and regulations on transboundary waste trade. Huddled around his desktop computer, we looked through inventories, diagrams, plans, certificates, and videos of remediation work. He explained that he's required to archive them for auditing purposes. This archival site materializes the Basel Convention, which aims, but not always succeeds, to prevent international waste dumping. It was a response to the kind of toxic waste colonialism exemplified by this very chemical stockpile. The archive is evidence of the consent from receiving countries to transnational waste trade, in addition to consent from the countries implicated by the transit of materials through their waters. But this isn't all that archives do. The images on these slides are stills from a video of workers recontaining the pesticides into new bags so they can be moved into a container and then shipped to Poland for incineration. We watched the remediation videos together. Workers in cumbersome hazmat suits slowly shoveled broken bottles and deteriorating sacks full of powder. James, the manager, downloaded the files onto my flash drive, but he did not permit me to share the videos. Instead, you get these stills. My paper in Environment and Planning D goes into the detail of removal, but what matters for this story is that this mess of powder, plastic, fraying sacks, and contaminated soil was transformed into standardized packages shaped by international law, legible forms of waste that can speak to processes of shipping. The material standardization also took place through paperwork, and this is a movement document for transboundary shipments of hazardous waste. The paperwork ultimately describes the stockpile of pesticides as DDT, one of the more common but by no means the only pesticide in this stockpile. So recontainment in removal reduced the stockpile, and you'll hear Latour here in kind of my observations, to a series of kind of flattened, reproducible inscriptions, so weights, codes, dates, destinations. In terms of the Basel Convention, which structures this transboundary shipment, this is a way of monitoring the movement of waste. But this abstraction also performs violence. The informational dimensions of pesticides, so labels, bottles, and distinct chemical signatures in particular, become lost in the process. The origin of the stockpile, where and when these pesticides were manufactured, how it was contained, can now only be partially understood through corporate archives that are largely inaccessible to the public. As I left the Veolia office, the team asked me to send them a photo of the site when I visited Tanzania. They were curious to see what it looked like. They knew they had left contamination behind, but they were only contracted to remove the visible pesticides. In January 2017, I visited the stockpile site with Haji, a chemist working for a Tanzanian environmental NGO. The assistant manager of the state-owned farm took the two of us on a tour. A noxious smell emerged as he swung open the heavy steel doors, a musty mix of chemicals and the passing of time. I'd been warned about contamination by environmental chemists who had studied the site. Haji took photographs of the crumbling concrete floor, and it was covered with dead animals, birds, moths, lizards, snakes, frogs, and millipedes. Haji explained that they likely died from pesticide exposure. So despite lingering contamination at the site, this stockpile is considered to be successfully removed by the World Bank. And here are the before and after photos used by Veolia to evidence its success. Another piece of this bureaucratic geography, which tells a very different story to the material geography at the site. Over several weeks in late 2012, the stockpile was incinerated at Veolia, at a Veolia hazardous waste incinerator in southern Poland. And of course, I followed its journey in 2016. I was taken on a tour of the facility by the lab manager, Incineration is a complex process that stretches out over days with shipments as hazardous as this stockpile. There is a flurry of paperwork necessary for hazardous materials to be legally transported across political boundaries. There are therefore kind of two parallel deliveries which take place. One is the waste and two is the informational dimensions that are accompanying it. So you can see there on the table, there's forms that delivery drivers have to fill out. The form, like the shipment document, simplifies the messy practice, the messy pesticides and containers into standardized categories that can speak with multiple phases of incineration, but erases their story yet again. A sample of waste is also taken for small-scale trial combustion and then is stored in an archive. This is a process of accountability, and it's kept in a store for 3 months after incineration is complete, and then afterwards is also incinerated. The lab's primary concern is monitoring the emission of regulated pollutants, including nitrogen oxide, dust, hydrochloric acid, and carbon monoxide. The discussion of the residues of the disposal were intentional releases of matter and monitored pollutants. So this is important to remember. Materials that are recognized in the process. And so there are a host of other unmonitored materials that are always emerging in incineration. And these emissions eventually fall to the ground into the food chain, moving from plants to livestock to the bodies of humans, all the while magnifying in levels of toxicity when it comes to pollutants like dioxins. Ultimately, this uncertainty is capitalized on when incinerators must defend their emissions. 5 minutes. All righty. I go on and on here about data, which is really interesting. It's really important, but I might skip it. So basically, all of the residues of the incineration process, the most hazardous ones, are sent to a secondary facility mixed with a hardened polymer so they can be stabilized, and they end up in landfills. So it's kind of incineration is not the end of the story. So the pesticide containers, their labels, chemical signatures, all that can be used to connect, the evidence that can be used to connect contamination with its source are erased in incineration. So a lot of the time you'll hear environmentalist discourses around the environmental and health effects of incinerators. I think there is a kind of an epistemological violence that's happening as well. Certificates like this are mobilized to mask lingering residues by evidencing that this problem has been solved. It's a destruction certificate. So the bureaucratic dimensions of disposal matter because they ultimately have material repercussions, and they render residues of stockpiles, which still linger in bodies and sites, distant and proximate, invisible. So a year ago, I would have stopped this talk here, inviting us to reflect on the violence and erasures that regulators enable. However, I'm beginning to ask, how should I respond? Regulatory science is currently being transformed in more globalized institutions at the moment. And this is where I've been trying to contribute. At the fifth session of the United Nations Environment Assembly in 2022, member states adopted a resolution deciding that a science policy panel should be established to support action on chemical pollution on waste. It's kind of like this chemical IPCC is expected to fill gaps between science and policy with lots of data, I imagine. The scientists I'm currently collaborating with have highlighted how the contributions of the social sciences and humanities to these kind of spaces have been overlooked. Indeed, researchers from the social sciences and humanities are often entirely absent in international chemical governance meetings, and the social and political dimensions of chemicals remain predominantly represented by civil society organizations. These silos and erasures are, of course, not unique or recent, but I've become part of these conversations and I'm supporting the UK government's contribution to the panel. And our conversations around social science contributions are largely focused on how we can enable ways of thinking and acting beyond risk and managerial logics, which constrain action by requiring that debates always take place in scientific framing. So science can't solve moral, ethical, political problems. And I see this as an exciting moment for transdisciplinary research, and I will leave it there.